Today is Thursday, April 8th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. President Joe Biden sets his sights on gun control.
And Biden will announce a series of executive actions he can take, like requiring background checks for homemade ghost guns.
Also, China sends more fighter jets into Taiwan's air defense.
The United States maintains the capacity to resist any resort to force that would jeopardize the security of the people on Taiwan.
Plus, African heads of states push for global fight against climate change and COVID. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in the U.S. President Joe Biden has been calling on Congress to pass gun control legislation in the wake of several recent mass shootings. But on Thursday, he's taking steps on his own. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
Senior administration officials say President Biden will tab former federal agent David Chipman as the new director of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. Chipman's been an advisor to the Giffords Gun Control Group, named for former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. And Biden will announce a series of executive actions he can take, like requiring background checks for homemade ghost guns, requiring stabilizing braces for pistols to be registered and taxed, and devoting finances to community intervention programs aimed at reducing gun violence in urban areas. The Justice Department will also provide guidance on making it easier for states to remove guns from people a court has deemed dangerous. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Security at the U.S. Capitol is once again under consideration after the second deadly attack on U.S. Capitol police in less than 3 months. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports on the tough decisions before U.S. officials as they try to keep the seat of U.S. democracy open to the public.
One of the nation's most recognized buildings.
No entry or exit is permitted at this time in any building of the Capitol complex.
Attacked for the second time this year. U.S. Capitol Police Officer William Evans died last week when an attacker slammed his car into a concrete barrier constructed to protect the U.S. Capitol after the September 11th terrorist attacks.
So what worked was the fact that the vehicle was stopped, the intruder's access was limited, and the police force did respond in a way that neutralized the threat to those on the Capitol Hill.
But that attack comes less than 3 months after another U.S. Capitol police officer lost his life during the January 6 riot by pro-Trump supporters attempting to prevent Congress's certification of Joe Biden's presidential election victory, raising new questions about protecting the nation's lawmakers.
The levels, you know, for the, what the mission is of the Capitol Police Force are quite low. It's, you know, about 2,300 people, 2,000 officers, about 300 civilians for a mission that is extraordinarily wide and large.
After the riot, thousands of U.S. National Guard troops and two rings of heavy-duty fencing boosted security around the Capitol, changing what had once been the most accessible of all U.S. government buildings.
Democracy is supposed to be about open government. And if you have all of this fencing and all of these barricades around the Capitol, then it suggests that the government isn't open.
A security review released last month by retired Lieutenant General Russell Honoré recommended permanent mobile fencing and a mounted guard around the Capitol. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
The Biden administration announced on Wednesday it planned to provide $235 million in U.S. aid to Palestinians. The move restarts funding for the United Nations Agency supporting refugees and restores other assistance cut off by former President Donald Trump. Zachary Goldman of Reuters reports.
The Biden administration on Wednesday announced it would send at least $235 million in U.S. aid to the Palestinians, restoring funding cut off by former President Donald Trump.
U.S. foreign assistance for the Palestinians serves important U.S. interests and values.
The aid will flow primarily to the United Nations Relief Works Agency, or UNRWA, which provides schools, food, and shelter to Palestinian refugees in the West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. Speaking to Reuters in the Jordanian capital, the head of UNRWA on Wednesday said the funds couldn't come soon enough.
The situation has been absolutely terrible, and there was a feeling of abandonment from the international community.
The package is part of an effort to repair U.S. ties with the Palestinians that all but collapsed during Trump's tenure. The Trump administration blocked nearly all aid after it severed ties with the Palestinian Authority in 2018. That move was widely seen as an attempt to force the Palestinians to negotiate with Israel on terms the Palestinian leadership said would deny them a viable state. Biden's aides have also signaled that they want to reestablish the goal of a negotiated two-state solution as a priority in U.S. policy on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
The United States is committed to advancing prosperity, security, and freedom for both Israelis and Palestinians in tangible ways in the immediate term, which is important in its own right, of course, but also as a means to advance towards a negotiated two-state solution.
But they have moved cautiously so far, and any major steps are likely to wait for the dust to clear after Israel's inconclusive March election, which will be followed by Palestinian elections scheduled in coming months.
That's Zachary Goldman of Reuters. Israel's ambassador to the United States and the United Nations, Gilad Erdan, criticized the resumption of funding to the United Nations agency supporting refugees, saying that it allowed anti-Israel incitement and anti-Semitic activities in its facilities.
Israel is strongly opposed to the anti-Israel and anti-Semitic activity happening in UNRWA's facilities. We believe that this UN agency for so-called refugees should not exist in its current format. UNRWA schools regularly use materials that incite against Israel, and the twisted definition used by the agency to determine who is a refugee only perpetuates the conflict. In conversations with the U.S. State Department, I have expressed my disappointment and objection to the decision to renew UNRWA's funding without first ensuring that certain reforms, including stopping the incitement and removing anti-Semitic content from its educational curriculum, are carried out. UNRWA is an organization that engaged in political advocacy and enables incitement to violence. Therefore, it should not exist in its current form.
Thus, Israel's ambassador to the United States and the United Nations, Gilad Erdan. Prosecutors continued to make their case Wednesday, the eighth day in the trial of Derek Chauvin, a former Minneapolis police officer charged in the death of George Floyd. VOA's Esha Sarai has more.
In the eighth day of the murder trial of former Minneapolis officer Derek Chauvin, a use of force expert testified that Chauvin's force against George Floyd, who died after Chauvin kneeled on his neck for over 9 minutes, was deadly.
He was in the prone position. He was handcuffed. He was not attempting to evade. He was not attempting to resist. And the pressure that was being caused by the body weight could cause positional asphyxia, which could cause death.
As the prosecution has focused on Chauvin's use of force and whether it was in line with his training, the defense has argued that Floyd had drugs in his system that could have contributed to his death.
Did it appear that Mr. Floyd said, "I ate too many drugs"?
Yes, it did.
But later, after hearing the same video played with longer context, Ryerson changed his answer.
I believe Mr. Floyd was saying, "I ain't doing no drugs."
So it's a little different than what you were asked about when you only saw a portion of the video, correct?
Yes, sir.
A forensic specialist also testified Wednesday, telling the jury that she had confirmed that blood found in the squad car matched Floyd's DNA. Chauvin faces murder and manslaughter charges in a trial that is expected to last weeks. Floyd's death last May sparked international protests defending black lives and decrying police brutality. Esha Sarai, VOA News, Washington.
China sent more fighter jets into Taiwan's air defense zone on Wednesday in a stepped-up show of force around the island Beijing claims as its own, and Taiwan foreign minister said it would fight to the end if China attacks. Gloria Tso of Reuters reports.
China stepped up a show of force around Taiwan on Wednesday, sending more fighter jets into the island's self-defense zone. Taiwan's foreign minister responded by warning it would fight to the end in case of war. The democratic self-governed island, which China claims as its own, has complained of escalating military activity by Beijing in recent months. On Monday, China said an aircraft carrier group was exercising around the island, while the U.S. Navy said it had conducted a, quote, routine transit of the Taiwan Strait on Wednesday. U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price on Wednesday described Washington's commitment to Taiwan as, quote, rock solid.
In support of longstanding U.S. policy, again, as reflected in the Taiwan Relations Act, the United States maintains the capacity to resist any resort to force or other forms of coercion that would jeopardize the security or the social or economic system of the people on Taiwan.
Washington is Taiwan's most important international backer and arms supplier, and it's been pushing Taipei to modernize its military and become a porcupine hard for China to attack. Taiwan's Foreign Minister Joseph Wu said Taiwan was determined to improve its military capabilities and spend more on defense and would run war simulations later this month. China, which claims its Taiwan activities are aimed at protecting Chinese sovereignty, did not respond to requests for comment on Wu's remarks.
That's Gloria Tso of Reuters. South Korea and the United States signed their new defense cost-sharing deal on Thursday in Seoul. The agreement includes a 13.9% increase in South Korea's contribution to the cost of hosting 28,500 U.S. troops for 2021, the biggest annual rise in nearly two decades, after U.S. calls for greater funding. South Korea's Vice Foreign Minister Choi Jang-kuk and Rob Rapson, Charge of Affairs at the U.S. Embassy in Seoul, signed a Special Measures Agreement, SMA, at a ceremony at the South Korean Ministry of Foreign Affairs. The increase under the multi-year pact takes South Korea's contribution for 2021 to $1.05 billion and settles a dispute that has strained ties between Seoul and Washington during Donald Trump's presidency. American troops are deployed to South Korea as a deterrent to Pyongyang that also sends a message to China about U.S. influence and capability in Asia. Britain has pledged $59 million to help people arriving from Hong Kong find jobs, houses, and schools on an initiative allowing millions to resettle after China's imposition of new security laws in a former British colony. Brian Wood of Reuters reports.
Britain has pledged support for people from Hong Kong looking to resettle in the UK to the tune of $59 million. It's part of a wider effort to let millions of Hong Kongers into Britain after China imposed new security laws in its former colony. The UK said Thursday the money will mostly go to programs for English language support and housing and efforts to help those from Hong Kong find jobs. Since January, thousands of Hong Kong residents have been able to apply for special five-year visas and eventually become UK citizens. With the new offer, Britain plans to launch a dozen welcome hubs around the UK to help with registering for healthcare, schools, and provide advice for setting up businesses there. Britain says it is fulfilling a historic and moral commitment to the people of Hong Kong and that China's security laws are being used to silence dissent. Ministers say the visa program is a way of honoring their side of the deal to hand Hong Kong back to Beijing in 1997. China has reacted angrily to the UK's efforts and have said that the West's views are clouded by misinformation and imperialism. So far, 27,000 people applied for the visa scheme through March, and the UK expects 300,000 people to apply over the next 5 years.
That's Brian Wood of Reuters. The first ever West African Joint Operations Regional Exercise went for the heart of extremism in Africa, focusing on the nations of Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger. But it focused on tackling the threat not through the military, but through the law enforcement and the justice systems. VOA's Anita Power reports from Johannesburg.
About 80 law enforcement and judiciary officers participated in last week's inaugural program, a small figure compared to the thousands of personnel who usually take part in military-led counterterrorism exercises. But this modest exercise, which recently concluded, could have a big impact against terrorism, said Julie Cabus, Deputy Assistant Secretary and Assistant Director of the Training Directorate in the State Department's Bureau of Diplomatic Security.
For this exercise, we focused on gathering timely, accurate evidence while working with judicial authorities to ensure adherence to local laws. Goals of the exercise included enhancing the investigative capacity and capability of units focused on terrorism cases in Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, ensuring investigations adhere to the rule of law and the principles of human rights, and facilitating regional cross-border cooperation by sharing best practices.
Her U.S. federal agency is responsible for securing diplomacy and protecting the integrity of U.S. travel documents. Because of its global mandate, the service has the largest geographic reach of any U.S. federal law enforcement agency, with more than 270 offices outside the U.S. Michael Gonzalez, Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Bureau of African Affairs, says the small targeted efforts form an important part of the State Department's counterterrorism strategy in West Africa's Sahel region, which include the countries that participated in the exercise: Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger. All three of those nations have seen a rise in terrorist activity in recent years. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is the Voice of America. Young people set a hijacked bus on fire and hurled gasoline bombs at police in Belfast in at least the fourth night of serious violence in a week in Northern Ireland, where Britain's exit from the European Union has unsettled an uneasy political balance. Myanmar's ambassador to the United Kingdom, who had criticized the military coup in his country, says he has been locked out of his London office by colleagues. Yao Xiaomin said he was barred from entering the embassy on Wednesday evening by diplomats loyal to the military government. Last month, the ambassador called for the release of Myanmar's democratic leader Aung San Suu Kyi, who was detained when the military seized power on February 1st. Israelis are marking the annual Memorial Day for the Holocaust's 6 million Jewish victims. Public buses and cars stopped on the streets and highways as a two-minute siren wailed across the country on Thursday. Pedestrians stood in place in memory of those killed in the Nazi genocide. The Holocaust is a keystone element of Israel public consciousness, and the annual memorial is one of the most somber days in the national calendar. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. India has been recording the highest numbers of COVID-19 cases in the world as it grapples with a second wave of the pandemic. As Anjana Patricia reports from New Delhi, the impact of the massive surge of the virus in the world's biggest vaccine maker will be felt far beyond its shores as India slows vaccine shipments to other countries.
A packed marketplace in Mumbai, just days before India's financial capital, hit record high infections. A month-long religious festival that sees hundreds take a dip in the river Ganges daily. People without masks at huge political rallies being held in five states holding local elections. Many in India stopped following COVID protocols as cases dropped earlier this year. The price? A second wave that has climbed more swiftly than the first, making India the world's COVID-19 hotspot. Its daily tally crossed 100,000 cases this week. Worst affected regions such as Maharashtra state reimposed restrictions. Its capital, Mumbai, shut down shops, restaurants and beaches and imposed a weekend curfew. Delhi has imposed a night curfew. That is worrying the millions who had returned to casual jobs in cities that had resumed normal life after a stringent lockdown. To stem the rapid rise of infections, India has boosted its inoculation drive. Health officials this month have begun targeting the younger age group believed to be driving the rising numbers. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
New Zealand on Thursday temporarily suspended entry for all travelers from India, including its own citizens, for about 2 weeks, following a high number of positive coronavirus cases arriving from the South Asian country. Gloria So of Reuters reports again.
New Zealand has temporarily banned all travelers from India after a surge of imported COVID-19 cases from the country. The move comes after New Zealand recorded 23 new coronavirus cases on Thursday, 17 of which were from India. New Zealand had virtually eliminated the virus from its borders and hasn't reported local transmissions for over a month. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern announced the ban Thursday, which will apply to anyone who has been in India over the past 2 weeks. The first time such a ban will include New Zealanders as well.
This will take effect from 4 p.m. on the 11th of April, this Sunday. That allows us time to draft the legal orders that will be required. This temporary suspension will remain in place till the 28th of April.
India has reported nearly 13 million cases of COVID-19, the third highest tally in the world after the United States and Brazil, and it's currently battling an even harsher second wave of the disease. New Zealand has implemented testing requirements to reduce the number of imported COVID-19 cases, but Ardern added that has not helped with the surge from India. New Zealand also reported one new locally infected case on Thursday, an employee at a coronavirus isolation facility.
The World Health Organization is launching a campaign to build a fairer, healthier post-pandemic world by tackling poverty and health inequities. In marking this year's World Health Day, WHO is issuing a call for action to improve the health of all people. Lisa Schneier reports for VOA from Geneva.
The COVID-19 pandemic reveals in stark detail the disparities that exist between those who have access to the healthcare and vaccines that are likely to save their lives and those who do not and are more likely to die from this disease. Latest World Health Organization figures show close to 132 million confirmed cases of COVID-19, including more than 2.8 million deaths globally. The UN agency says so far, more than 604 million vaccine doses have been administered, most in about a dozen of the world's wealthiest countries. While everyone is affected by the pandemic, WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says the poorest and most marginalized are hardest hit in terms of lives and livelihoods lost. He says vital changes must be made in the year ahead to achieve greater equity between the haves and have-nots.
We need to invest in equitable production and access to COVID-19 rapid tests, oxygen treatments, and vaccines between and within countries. There must be a serious investment in primary health care and getting health services to every member of every community.
Tedros notes the COVAX vaccine sharing facility has delivered 36 million doses to 86 low and middle income countries and economies. He says production and equitable distribution must be scaled up as this remains the major barrier to ending the acute stage of this pandemic. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
African heads of state met virtually this week to make a push for the global community to do more to fight climate change in Africa, arguing that the environmental crisis worsens the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic in the developing world. They are pushing a multi-billion dollar plan to change that. Here again is VOA's Anita Powell.
A pandemic has blanketed the planet. Economies have cratered. Across the world, people are scared, anxious, and unsteady about the future. And you want to talk about climate change? Yes, say African leaders. Now. This week, as many nations headed into a third pandemic wave, African leaders stood up ahead of a vital climate conference planned for later this year and made their case for why the world needs to do more now to help Africa adapt to climate change. It is hardly news that the pandemic has dealt a body blow to the developing world, says Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. But he says it has affected everything.
Is one of the most vulnerable continents to climate change and climate vulnerability, a situation that unfortunately has been aggravated by the COVID-19 pandemic.
Or, as President Ali Bongo Ondimba of Gabon put it, in a way that will seem familiar to residents of this vast continent that is larger than the combined landmass of the United States, China, and Brazil.
Every day, the thunderstorms seem more violent, flooding is more frequent, and droughts more severe.
What does this have to do with the pandemic? Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the director of the World Health Organization, draws that line clearly. Although the continent has reported a relatively low number of cases compared to other regions, it has seen the world's slowest rollout of vaccination campaigns. These leaders are pushing the global community to put their money behind their commitment. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.